So yesterday's lecture was an attempt to justify the structure of superstring theory by looking at the example of a superparticle. So inspired by that, we arrived at the conclusion that one can try to define a string theory with fermions by sort of supersymmetrizing all the steps of the usual bosonic string derivation, writing down a supersymmetric version of the Polyakov action with some supersymmetry in the worksheet. And after gauge fixing, after all the dust settled, one ends up with something that has more or less the same schematic form as the bosonic string, except that there is fermions everywhere on the worksheet. So for example, there will be some integral over some moduli space of super complex structures on the worksheet. And then there will be some path integral over the usual positions fields together with some fermionic partners, the usual ghosts together with some fermionic, some bosonic partners. Some action, which, and then insertions of all sorts. There will be some B insertions for the bosonic decrease of freedom of these complex structures, and some beta insertions whatever. For whatever fermionic degrees of freedom are there in defining these complex structures. I'm not going to discuss today essentially anything about ghosts, about moduli spaces, super moduli spaces, or whatnot. I'm just going to focus on these guys, well, together with these guys, with the matter degrees of freedom, try to sort of sketch what the spectrum of superstring theory will be. Defining properly the geometry of these super worksheets and figuring out how to integrate for this geometry is a pretty interesting and technical problem that was more or less addressed in the 80s with some gaps that have been filled quite recently. People are just learning now how to compute higher loop amplitudes in superstring theory. But in a sense, to understand how superstring works and how it looks like, you don't really need to perturb much perturbation theory. I mean, there are not many reasons for which you want to compute a true loop amplitudes in superstring theory. So most of today's lecture will be devoted to understanding a theory of free fermions on the Riemann surface. So we'll try to do something analogous to what we did for the free boson. So for the free boson, the main challenge, in a sense, was to understand vertex operators, operators which are dual to states carrying momentum. For the fermion, perhaps the biggest challenge is to understand what's called spin structure. Now, the action for the fermions is rather simple, something like this. As you can see, in order for this action to make sense, fermions have to transform in a somewhat peculiar way under changes of coordinates. So essentially, if fermions are spinors, they transform as square roots of vectors, intuitively. And very practically, if you take a fermion in some coordinate system, you try to rewrite it in a different coordinate system, you do literally use the square root of the Jacobian. Notice that the equation of motion set the fermions classically to be holomorphic, the psi's to be holomorphic, the psi bars to be anti-holomorphic. So in the language that we introduced, we were discussing primary operators. The holomorphic fermion is an operator with scaling dimension, holomorphic scaling dimension 1/2, and anti-holomorphic scaling dimension 0. Now, because of this square root, the sign of a fermion can be a bit confusing. For example, suppose it has some worksheet. And you ask the question, okay, if I take my fermion and I carry it along some path around my worksheet, is it going to come back to itself or to minus itself? Well, this question depends on which coordinate system you're using. Because it's possible to have two coordinate systems which are both perfectly well defined, identified in the neighborhood of this path, and which have the property that the Jacobian has a phase which rotates by one unit as you go around. So if the Jacobian goes to e to the 2 pi I the Jacobian, the fermion is going to go to e to the I pi Jacobian, the fermion. So this fermion might, if this fermion might be periodic, while this might be antiperiodic. So I'm saying, suppose I go around once.
Wouldn't you always have antiperiodic boundary?
No, it depends on the coordinate system you're using. Right? Just because the square root might change sign as you go, might just not be well defined all over your path. So that's essentially that, and then there are, constraints on what happens when you compare different paths. Now, if you have a cylinder and you pick flat coordinates on the cylinder, you can say unequivocally, without confusion, you can say, okay, this is the fermion is periodic or is antiperiodic. These two choices are called Ramond and Ewell-Schwarz. So on a cylinder with Ramond boundary conditions, psi of sigma plus 2 pi equals psi. In the NNS sector, psi of sigma plus 2 pi equals minus psi. Yes?
But if these are coordinates, artifacts,
and
this is like a physical distinction?
So if you pick a coordinate system, it's physical to ask if the fermion is periodic or antiperiodic. But now when you have a complicated worksheet, like something like this, or maybe something like this, so on, and you ask yourself, okay, if I take my fermion to be periodic here in the canonical coordinate system in this half cylinder, and I ask for it to be periodic here, is it going to be periodic or antiperiodic here? Is a question that can be answered, just by comparing the cognitive transformations. And you discover, for example, that if it's periodic here and it's periodic here, it becomes antiperiodic here. And on the other hand, you discover that if it's antiperiodic in all three legs, it's okay. So you might think, okay, fine, I'll just restrict myself to antiperiodic around every tube. But it actually doesn't work. If you take something like this and you say that it's wanted to be periodic this way, and maybe periodic this way, so antiperiodic this way and antiperiodic this way, well, it will end up being periodic if you go on some path, which is the sum of these two. Okay. So you end up having to sort of incorporate both periodic and antiperiodic sectors in your theory. Yes?
Does it matter in the scattering amplitudes, or is everything bilinear in the Feynman simulation?
Sorry?
Does it matter in the scattering amplitudes, which choices we make?
Well, this quantization and this quantization will give you a completely different Hilbert space. Get different possible space of space. And now you need to decide which one to include in your theory consistently. And you can make such a choice both for psi and for psi bar. So, if you look at the space of states on a cylinder, you can define a space of states with Ramond-Ramond, space of states with Ramond and S, space of states with NS Ramond, and a space of states with an S and S. Yes?
This value for the weights of this fermionic leak, does it come from an operator expansion, or do we impose it? How do we get to it?
Well, it's the only choice that makes this action while invariant. It is also essentially a definition of a fermion in the sense that if you start by doing things in the usual way with gamma matrices and all of that, and then you go to the sort of conformal gauge, you end up with something like this. So you can really start with putting a metric, using gamma matrices, studying wild transformations of the usual psi, del bar psi, del slash psi action. And then when you go to conformal gauge, you end up with this.
How do we know that this is the right action for fermions? Does it have to give the Dirac equation in some limit of work?
So first of all, it follows from the Dirac equation when you fix the metric to be flat and you work on Gomez Kaufman. Second, we want supersymmetry on the worksheet. So it turns out that this action is supersymmetric. If you make other choices, it might not be. Mm-hmm.
Can you extend this to like the original action with the square root, like still having this supersymmetry?
Sorry?
Can you also impose this supersymmetry at the level of still having the square root? I think that's number two.
Yes, I believe so. I think there is. I remember seeing it written down. And so I believe that if you take the super Polyakov action that I sketched yesterday, we have gravity and gravitino. You integrate away gravity and gravitino, you will end up with a super Namugoto action. I actually wanted to do the exercise yesterday night, but I didn't get around to it. It should be written somewhere. Probably not in Polishinsky, but there are textbooks. I don't know which one.
So here, this boundary conditions, is it part of the modular space, or is it just an extra degree of freedom?
At the moment, it's so when I try to pack to define my worksheet,
yeah.
I need to make these choices.
Yeah.
And as you, it turns out there is no canonical choice. So these choices are called choice of spin structure. And there is no short spin structure, which remains the same as you deform your surface in all possible ways. So essentially, what you have to do is to sum over all possible choices in order to get a consistent answer. But even in doing so, there is a subtlety which I would like to discuss, which is very important. So it's useful to introduce some Fermi number operators, which are 1 or minus 1, with a property that psi has Fermi number 1, and psi bar has Fermi number, ontomorphic Fermi number 1. So after doing that, with a little bit of work, you can split each of these Hilbert spaces into four pieces, depending on the charge on the Fnet bar. There are some subtleties on how to define these quantum numbers, and you need to include the super ghosts in the definition to do it properly. But you can do this. And then you discover there is another constraint. See, so it turns out that if you have a Riemann surface which has states, suppose that you have a state in one of these tubes which is of I think to discuss this is best if I introduce first the state operator correspondence. Okay, so let's apply this particular rule to the state operator map, which was this transformation roughly, right? So you discover that if you start on a cylinder with Ramon boundary condition, you end up on a plane with a configuration where psi is antiperiodic. As you go around the origin. Well, if you do things with an S boundary conditions, which are periodic, which are antiperiodic on the cylinder, you end up periodic in the plane. Essentially, this is because the square root of the Jacobian is e to the s over 2, the square root of z. So if you think in terms of local operators rather than states, a Ramon state has the property that the Fermi is antiperiodic around it. More generally, anything which has Fermi number 1, so negative, so Fermi odd Fermi number, will be antiperiodic around it. So if you try to have in your theory a local operator which is in the Ramon sector, and a local operator which has minus 1 to the f, to the I pi f equal to minus 1, and you try to carry this operator around, it will go to minus itself. So this means that this correlation function is ill-defined. It has a sign of ambiguity. When you try to do things like integrating over all positions of the punctures, you'll end up with 0, just because, or with something ill-defined. It depends on how to define the integral precisely. So there is a constraint that you cannot put at the same time operators which are not local to each other on the worksheet. I could have made a similar statement at the level of tubes. It's a little bit more complicated to wrap your head around, but it's the same statement. So it's also true that if I have a Riemann surface which has a tube of type R, and I put here a state with minus 1 to the I pi f equal to minus 1, I will get trouble. Mm-hmm.
I don't really understand yet how these Fermi numbers work exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that psi has Fermi number 1, so a combination like psi, psi, then that's Fermi number 2.
Yes, the Fermi number is defined up to, see, this is the only operator. It's really a sign. So f is defined modulo 2. So psi psi has Fermi number 0, essentially.
Should that be minus 1 to the f then? Or e to the I pi f? It's minus 1
sorry,
to the
yes. Yes, I'm sorry. That was silly. Yes, it's minus 1 to the f, minus 1 to the bar. That's what I meant. So,
but how do these Fermi numbers then link to the R or NS boundary?
They're independent. So each state could be sitting in some, in any of these four sectors, and could have any possible choice of left and right Fermi numbers.
But I thought the Fermi number for psi was fixed.
Yes. So inside this, inside here, for example, I will find states which are dual to psi, to 1, to psi psi, or and so on, to psi psi bar, and so on and so forth. They're going to have Fermi number plus or minus 1, plus or minus 1. Fermi number 0, 1, 0, 1.
Because several of the psi's or psi bars come together to form one state.
That's right. Well, right, so there's a state operator map. I've not described it yet in detail. But from this picture, you can sort of guess that, for example, if I have the identity operator, it's going to be dual to something in the NS sector. Because the identity operator clearly does not introduce any cut in the definition of your fermions. Conversely, you might wonder which sort of operator in the fermion theory has this property. The fermions themselves don't. So in order to define this, I need something a little bit similar to the vertex operator in the boson. It's a new operator which is not defined. Actually, it's even trickier than the vertex operator in the bosons, because the vertex operator in the boson could really be written as a function of the boson. But in order to study operators that correspond to Ramon factors, it's tricky. The best definition is essentially that they are the dual to the states. But I'll get to that in a moment. For now, I just wanted to observe that there are these four choices of sector and these four choices of signs. And when you try to define a theory, they must be tied together in some way. Because otherwise, you get something that is meaningless. The rule for what to keep in a self-consistent way are called GSO projections. Now, it turns out that the number of possible GSO projections that are available to you depend on how many fermions you have available. Because in principle, if you have many, many copies of the fermions, you can try to play all sort of games. Funnily enough, the superstring theory has just the right number of fermions to do some unusual choices. So there are some choices that you can do no matter how many fermions you have, and some choices which can only be done when you have a specific number of fermions. So it turns out that there is a choice that you can only make when you have, if you just had a psi, it would be something that you can do whenever you have a multiple of 8 fermions. When you put in the betas and the gammas as well, it turns out that 10 psi is okay. So there is a choice which is only available if you have 10 psi's, betas, and gammas. And this choice allows you to keep all four sectors, meaning you keep RR, RNS, NSR, and SNS, but only plus plus. Right? So one choice, which is the one that gives the two superstring theories type 2, is that you keep H++, but anything that you want. This is will turn out to be a very nice choice. There are other choices, which are the more boring, that you can do, which are things like where you keep only, say, RR and SNS. But then you can allow yourself to be plus plus or minus minus. You see that this choice has no locality problems because it has no operators with this property at all. This choice allows you things that are minus minus, but are also Ramon Ramon. So that the sign that you get from the left movers cancels against the one you get from the right movers. And now, it's true that somehow when you do these sort of manipulations on Riemann surfaces that tell you that you cannot just keep an S or Ramon, these manipulations act on left movers and right movers at the same time. So it makes sense to say, I only want things where left movers behave in the same way as right movers. So this is what you can do always. For example, if you take a single fermion and you make these choices, you get something called the Ising model, which you might have encountered in statistical mechanics. But in superstrings, it's most interesting to do this kind of choice.
Here you have two boundary conditions, like Riemann, Riemann, or NSNS. Is
yes.
It like two external tubes or just one?
No, just one tube, but maybe I could put a bar here to make it more clear. You need to decide what you do with the left mover, with the size,
okay.
And you need to do what you do with need to decide what to do with side bars.
But it isn't, I mean, it isn't restricted by how many fermions you have in the initial or the final state?
This is a property of the theory, not of the state. So you quantize the theory with some boundary conditions, and you get a Hilbert space. You quantize it a different set of boundary conditions, you get a different Hilbert space. Then you can adapt the Hilbert spaces together. This is a bit similar to the winding mode we were discussing when you had t-duality. When we were doing t-duality and our bosons were compact, we could include situations where our bosons were having a monodromy as you went around your circle. And these were the winding modes. So we would quantize the theory in each winding sector and then add them up together. Okay, so thanks. So this is the JSO projection. So now we can concretely try to define, to figure out what the simple spaces are. So as you said, so you can take your psi as a function of S, and you can expand it in Fourier modes. Now in the NS sector, psi will have half integral Fourier modes because it's antiperiodic on the cylinder. Wonder what's the best way to write it. I just write it as integrals in n value in integrals plus 1/2. And then you have something like psi n e to the minus ns. In the Ramon sector, you write the same expression, but you'll expand in modes which are integral. So starting with that action, you get commutation relations, which are essentially very similar to the ones we saw for the ghosts. So the psis with positive modes are conjugate to the psis with negative modes. Now, in the NS sector, this number is either positive or negative. So every mode is either a raising or lowering operator. In the Ramon sector, there is a zero mode. So which behaves just like the modes we found on the superparticle. In particular, it's going to give you gamma matrices. So in the NS sector, we'll just get a single ground state. And then we'll start acting on it with fermionic modes. On the other hand, in the Ramon ground state, there will be multiple ground states, just because the ground states must be a representation of the zero modes. The zero modes must act somehow on your ground states. That means the ground states sit in some representation of this Clifford algebra, these gamma matrices. So essentially, the zero modes end up carrying a spinor index. And psi zero acts on the index as a gamma matrix. Okay. So the Ramon sector is what will bring fermions in our story. Notice that in the type zero theory, both the ground state, the states will be the tensor product of ground states for the left movers, for the holomorphic modes, and ground states for the anti-holomorphic modes. So they're going to have two spinor indices. They're not going to be actual spinors. The transform is a product of two spinors. But in the superstring, where we have the NS Ramon and the Ramon NS sectors, then we'll have some chance to have, we'll have states which carry one spinor index. So we'll have fermions. In space-time, I mean. We'll have space-time fermions. So in the Ramon ground sector, our Hilbert space will look like this. We start with these ground states, and then maybe we'll act with psi minus 1 on them to get something with spin to halves, okay, and so on and so forth. All right, here I'm just discussing the psi's. As I mentioned, we need to also make the same statements for the psi bars. And of course, if you do things properly, you should also do the same statements for the betas and the gammas. Try to figure out how do these ground states behave when acted upon by the betas and gammas. I'm not going to discuss it. But instead, I'll do things a little bit by hand, as we did at the very beginning. In order to identify the on-shell states of the string theory, I will just impose constraints similar to the LN to being annihilated by the LNs. So in the superstring theory, there are two sets of conditions. One involves the stress tensor, and the other involves the supercurrent. So let me just describe these two objects. So the stress tensor has a contribution from the scalar fields and a contribution from the fermions. And then there is a supercurrent, which is just psi del x. So both the stress tensor and the supercurrent can be expanded in modes. The modes of the supercurrent will have, again, integral or half-integral grading, depending on being in an S or a Mond sector. So you can define some modes Gn and some modes Ln, as before. I didn't write down the precise algebra. Together, they form something called the super-Virasoro algebra. So Ls commuting with Ls give you Ls. Ls commuting with Gs give you Gs. Gs commuting with Gs give you Ls. So this is a more complicated version of the supersymmetry algebra that we encountered yesterday. And our own shell states will be annihilated on the NS sector, will be annihilated by L0 minus some A, which we'll have to figure out, well, by LNs with positive N, and by GNs with positive N. While in the Ramon sector, well, the same will be true. Doesn't matter in S or Ramon. The main difference is that here there is in the Ramon sector, there is also G0. And because G0 squared gives you a zero, A is already fixed automatically in the Ramon sector. It's only in the S sector that you need to worry about it. So here there is there are different values depending on if you're in Ramon sector or NS sector. And actually, because you can get the Ls by anti-commuting Gs, it's usually enough to impose this condition, and it will automatically imply that. And you can write the Gs in a completely explicit way just by expanding this, right? You can see that roughly they will look like sum over k of ak psi n minus k. It's pretty straightforward. In the Ramon sector, g0 will include some a0 psi 0. Which you can recognize as being just P contracted with the gamma matrix. So as a Dirac operator. So in the bosonic string, L0 had a P square. So the L0 minus A condition ended up putting your particles on the mass shell. It ended up giving essentially the classic the equations of motion for the corresponding fields. In the superstring, in the Ramon sector, G0 will take care of imposing the Dirac equation. Of course, you can ask what's going to happen in the Ramon sector, and that's going to be fun. Okay, so how does the spectrum look like? Actually, maybe I can keep this blackboard. Sorry. So in the next sector, we start with our VAC, with our ground states, possibly with some momentum p. Okay. These states have zero Fermi number, essentially because they are related by the state operator map to the identity of the, in the fermionic. So I should have said that. So this is dual to the identity operator. This is dual to psi. This is dual to del psi. This is dual to psi del psi, and so on and so forth. These guys are dual to something, okay? Some local operator which carries the same quantum numbers. We call it sigma. And if you try to figure out how to define this operator in the theory, well, it's not that hard. Essentially, when you do your path integral of the fermions, you just tell the fermions to be antiperiodic over the point where you're inserting this, around the point where you're inserting this. So you do a path integral over all possible functions which are antiperiodic around this point. This defines an operator at that point, which is this sigma. And quantum mechanically, it ends up getting these extra indices because of the fermion zero modes. And so on. Now, so this, it turns out that A in the next sector is 1/2. Okay. So if this was really the correct statement, what I wrote on the board, you'd be very unhappy right away. Because it would mean that we had a tucking in the spectrum. Because B squared would have been 1/1. But it turns out that I lied. So I said that F and F bar were zero. Well, if we just had the fermions in there, that would be correct. It turns out that the super ghosts are quite subtle to understand properly. After you figure out how to use them, and it takes some time. It's not actually not even a matter of the super ghost. The fact is that when you do things properly, you have a C and a C bar here. So it's just the ghosts. Not super ghost, just that if you include the CNC bar that we know had to be there from so if you use the ghost ground state has Fermi number 1, holomorphic and anthelomorphic. So together they give you F equal to 1 and F bar equal to 1. So this state is actually eliminated in type 2. It should survive in type 0. So type 0 superstrings have a tucking. They're not interesting. Type 2 superstrings have to eliminate this guy in order to allow us to have these guys. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have raised this. Superstring theory does not have a tucking, has a chance to be well-defined. Next, we can start putting some oscillators. The simplest thing I can do, which has F and F bar both equal to 0, is this. is as f and f bar equal to 0, because psi cancels out against the ghost ground state. It carries two indices. Now we can try to figure out when is it on shell. We need to add to the G with G1 to check if it's on shell. G1 has inside a psi 1/2. So with G 1/2, because it's an S sector, which has inside a psi 1/2 contracted with an A0. And so the on shell condition turns out to be the usual epsilon mu nu p mu equal to 0, epsilon mu nu p nu equal to 0. And, of course, because this is dimension 1/2, and A is 1/2, p squared equal to 0. So here we found, in a slightly different guise, the graviton, B field, and dilaton. So this was GNS plus plus sector. Next, we can analyze the, say, NS arc sector. So now our state carries momentum and carries a spinor index because of that, because it's in the arc sector of the anthropomorphic mode. Here there is a slightly different ghost state because now the betas and gammas are also in the Ramon sector. And so now we need to figure out how does the minus 1 to the f bar act on these states. So remember, minus 1 to the f has to sort of anti-commute psi, because psi has a fermi number 1. So must be an operator which anti-commutes the zero mode. This was called the chirality operator. You can make it, for example, by taking the product of all the gamma matrices. Now, when you have an even number of dimensions, your spinors, your representations of the Clifford algebra, break down into halves, chiral and anti-chiral, with the gamma matrices mapping the chiral into the anti-chiral and vice versa. You've probably seen it in four dimensions. So the GSO projection will keep. Now it's up to you to decide if minus 1 to the f is 1 or minus 1 on the chiral, or if it's 1 or minus 1 on the anti-chiral. You get to make this choice on for the left movers, and you get to make this choice for the right movers. These two choices are called type 2a and type 2b. So in type 2a, you decide that on the left, for the left movers, minus 1 to the f acts as 1 on chirals, and f bar as 1 on anti-chiral halves. In type 2b, instead, we treat them more symmetrically, left and right. So here, depending on if you're in type 2A or in type 2B, you're going to get a chiral or an anti-chiral index. It turns out that A is 0 on the Ramon sector. So we still need to put the psi to the 1/2 here for the left movers, but the right movers are happy as they are. So this gives us a gravity, you know. Gravitino is just, so this is still massless, okay? So let me put some polarization. This guy is still massless because of the not equal to one half on the left movers. And now imposing the G naught annihilates it. Gives you some equation like P contracted with the gamma matrix. Equal to 0. So the gravitino is a massless spin 3/2 field. It has some crucial property which is common to the graviton. So whenever you have a graviton, your theory is a theory of gravity. We call it gravitons, always gives, the presence of a graviton essentially implies that your theory is different from Fismi invariant. Whenever you have a gravitino, you have a supergravity. So your theory is invariant under superdiffeomorphisms. So superstring theory ends up having a certain amount of supersymmetry in target space because of the presence of the gravitino. This has nothing to do with the supersymmetry we put on the worksheet. Now, both this sector and this sector will give a gravitino. So type 2 string has 2 sets of gravitinos. It has what's called an inequal 2 supersymmetry. The gravitinos might have either the same chirality or opposite chirality, depending if you're talking about type 2b or type 2a. At some point, long enough, so, people who like supergravity had written down the supergravity theories in 10 dimensions. And it turns out the string theory reduces to those supergravity theories at low energy. The structure of the supergravity theories is very, very constrained. Typical supersymmetry mixes up all the fields in your theory if you have enough of it. So it maps the graviton into the gravitino, and then the gravitino into something else, into the graviton and some other bosonic fields, often. The other bosonic fields are the ones that we encounter here. So in the Ramon-Ramon sector, we have now states which carry 2 sets of spinor indices of the same chirality or opposite chirality, depending if you are in type 2A or type 2B. Now, you probably have never encountered before fields which carry 2 spinor indices. Now, 2 spinor indices, it turns out that 2 spinor indices can always be converted into a certain number of vector indices, just by contracting it to the gamma matrix. So the gamma matrix also has 2 spinor indices, or products of gamma matrices. So you can contract these fields with gamma matrices to get objects which have vector indices. And now it might be a little bit confusing, though, that this object seems to satisfy first order differential equations. Because if you look at the on-shell condition, you get something like P gamma A B equal to 0, but also P gamma A bar B bar equal to 0. So instead of satisfying a standard, you know, a second order differential equation like P squared equal to 0, they satisfy 2 first order equations. But it's not so difficult to find a nice example in 4 dimensions or something like that. I think I must have one more blackboard. under. So suppose I'm studying electromagnetism. So usually you express electromagnetism in terms of the connection A or the gauge field A. But you could also try to write down the equations of motion in terms of the field strength. If you write it in terms of the field strength, you get something like this. The F vanishes in the absence of magnetic sources, and the star F vanishes. So if you write everything in terms of F, because F is the A satisfies this, and then the equation of motion for A becomes first order. Now, it turns out that there is also kind of a symmetry mixing up F and star F. Now, you could try to decompose F into something sort of even or odd under this symmetry. And it turns out that these guys are naturally written with spinor indexes, with two spinor indexes. In other words, if you take this, if you think in terms of gamma matrices, if you take the usual gamma matrices, you do something like this, anti-symmetrized, and you sort of write them. So you get something that has the sense left a chirality back, chiral back to chiral, or an anti-chiral back to anti-chiral. And it turns out that they correspond to these indices being self-dual or anti-self-dual. So there is a way to map an object to two spinor indices to something that is self-dual or an anti-self-dual. You can check it just by checking the dimension. A spinor index is two-dimensional, a chiral spinor, two-dimensional. This is a symmetric expression in two chiral spinors. An antisymmetric would be just a scalar. But a symmetric combination has three components. F starts its life with six components, but these projections cut it down to three and three. So if you look at representations of the Lorentz group, F contains two different representations, which can be characterized as the tensor product of symmetric power of a chiral or anti-chiral fermions. And then if you look at these equations do become a Dirac operator acting on alpha, or a Dirac operator acting on alpha dot. So something like this happens in 10 dimensions. In 10 dimensions, the states, depending if you are in type 2A or in type 2B, end up giving you field strengths. So in type 2A, you get something like an F mu nu sigma tau, and that's it, because you can in type 2B, you get F mu nu sigma, and then some F mu nu sigma tau rho, which is equal to the dual of it. So like epsilon, blah, 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 blah. So just decomposing this by spinors, you get all sorts of representations of the Lorentz group. These are called Ramond-Ramond fields. they're generalizations of gauge fields. They are field strengths of some connections, except this guy, which is the field strength of a scalar called the axion.
One of these series will have some deep brains of some dimension which cannot couple to any field like that, and will they be unstable?
Well, funnily enough, when you look at the deep brains in these theories, some of these deep brains will have a tachyon and some will not. The ones that have tachyons are unstable, don't really exist. And the ones that don't have a tachyon have precisely the correct dimensionality to couple to the corresponding fields. So the type Shu-A has a D0 brain and a D2 brain, then it has a D4 brain that couples magnetically to this, like a magnetic source. See, in four dimensions, electromagnetism could couple in principle to both electric particle and to magnetic monopoles. In 10 dimensions, this guy could couple to particles or to seven dimensional objects, seven space-time directions, so six dimensional objects. So you would couple to the zero brains and the six brains. This will couple to the two brains and the four brains.
Yeah.
This will couple to nothing. This will couple, well, to instant, mostly, it doesn't matter. This will couple to the one brains,
so
and this
said,
to the three brains.
You said that the other ones have a tachyon.
That's right.
They will decay.
They will decay. And they don't couple to. In a sense, the reason they can decay is because they don't couple, they don't carry charges. So these Ramon fields, so there are no string states which carry charges under these gauge fields. But this gauge field, but it turns out that if you try to figure out what are the sources generated by deep brains, the same way we discussed at the beginning of the week, deep brains will carry sources for these fields.
How are these fields related to the chiral charges? Like type 2A and type 2B have different chiral fields?
Well, see, depending on if you're in type 2A or in type 2B, in type 2B this would be a chiral index. It would be chiral and anti-chiral.
Okay. And how are they expressed?
So when you can just have this representation theoretic question. If I have the product of a chiral and chiral representation, chiral spinner and chiral spinner representations, which representations do I find? Or if I have the product of a chiral and anti-chiral, which representations do I find?
Chiral and
anti-chiral. But concretely, so I mean, it's a representation theoretic problem, and it takes maybe 15, maybe less, 15 minutes to figure it out. But it's written down in Polchinski. But you know, intuitively, you know, you get even or odd forms because products of even number of gamma matrices or products of odd number of gamma matrices have. Are either suitable to convert a bispinor of one type or a bispinor of the other type into a more familiar form.
Okay. For type 2A, there's no scalar as the derivative of the scalar.
And right, so in type 2B, you get an extra scalar in the Ramon sector, not in type 2A. I mean, there is some nice numerology which I can discuss. So, okay, no. There is no time to do that.
Okay.
But you can ask yourself, what's the dimension of the space of spinners? What's the dimension of the bispinner? Try to decompose it into dimensions of basics like this. Yeah, sorry. No, sorry, here in principle you could have had an F with no indices. Maybe this was the question?
Okay.
It would satisfy first order differential equation. It's really, so it does not give you a dynamical degree of freedom. You can imagine, it gives you just a constant mode. You can imagine turning it on. There's something called massive touch weight string theory, which in principle is what you get by turning this on. The problem is that we don't know how to describe it in terms of quark sheet, because we don't know how to turn on gamma on the grounds. It's a bit of an odd beast. It has very strange properties. Sometimes it's useful to think about it.
So usually we don't introduce like these higher spin fields
yes.
that you have over here because of gravity problems. How does this get solved in string theory?
Again, sorry?
So usually you can't really introduce these higher spin fields because you get problems with gravity and stuff.
Oh, these are not higher spin fields. So, okay, there's a question, what do you mean with higher spin in dimension higher than 4? So things that transform as forms are fine.
Okay.
In the same sense, their really properties very similar to electrodynamics. Things that transform with symmetric powers of symmetric indices, those will be much more problematic. And those are the ones that are the higher spin. In a sense, all of these are spin one in a four-dimensional analogy. Do you have any questions? This last lecture was a bit fast. Okay, then I guess we're done.